From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I don't follow sports, but even in a pandemic, the pull of the Super Bowl has me thinking about chicken wings. Undeniably delicious and impossible to screw up. They are endlessly customizable. For me, chicken wings are all about the flats. Maybe it's all those years cooking drumettes for catering jobs in the 80s, but I just prefer all flats or whole wings. First, with the flats, you get to eat with your fingers. Well, for both you do. And the meat just slips off those two little bones. Then there is the gift of the cartilaginous bits. If you make or you buy the whole wing, you get to experience so much more variation of texture as you work your way through the platter. Wings generally are about mass consumption, often under the influence. Ergo, I go for less flaming heat and salt and more for spicing, preferably two different kinds, so I can change up the flavor over the duration. My default is a not too sweet teriyaki-ish option involving garlic, soy, honey, and sesame oil. Sometimes these days I'll add a little touch of gochujang to make them a tad spicy and more savory. Then there's the Angeli-esque wing made of a marinade of copious amounts of olive oil, lemon juice, rosemary, and garlic. Both my wing options are pre-marinated, not post-sauced. If I need the addition of sauce or heat, I'll just use one of the six different chili crisp salsa matcha sauces I have currently in the pantry. Many lifer Angelenos like myself grew up seeing the spinning signage of Pioneer Chicken featuring a covered wagon. Chef Brandon Keena of Hinoki and the Bird was obsessed with recreating the rust-colored crunchy wings for his latest project just in time for Super Bowl Sunday. For those missing their fix from Pioneer Pete, Keena's Go-Go Bird is your answer. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Tell me your memories of Pioneer Chicken, or if you still enjoy them.
Yes, well, back when I was a child, I used to love going out to fast food. It was one of our, you know, for many people, I mean, going out to fast food as a child, it's such a treat. You know, you get to go to McDonald's, or for me, it was Pioneer Chicken. And I used to love walking in there and smelling that grease. I know it sounds weird, but the smell of like fried food is very comforting to me. And the style of the fried chicken that they used to do, the crunchy exterior and the moist interior was eye-opening to me as a child.
Yes, so good. I remember it too as a child.
Do you?
Oh, of course. They were everywhere when I was like a little kid. It was either Pioneer Chicken or Golden Bird.
Right. And everyone used to debate who likes what better, yeah.
Exactly. So your original pandemic hustle was to make takeout dumplings in the form of go-go gyoza. When and why did you decide to get into the chicken game?
Well, I really learned a lot from the gyoza. You know, being in fine dining my entire career, it's very rare that you get to tap into these kind of childhood memories so deeply and so matter-of-factly. So when the pandemic came along, dumplings were the first thing that really kind of comforted me and kind of was an easy entryway into a small business. So I kept going with that. And the next thing that popped into my head was fried chicken. I love fried chicken. I loved it as a child and I love it as an adult. So it was just an easy transition for me, just tapping into those memories.
So you grew up in Koreatown. How does your cooking, either with the wings or without the wings, speak to Los Angeles?
So we call it an LA-style fried chicken because of the inspirations behind it. So, of course, we talked about Pioneer Chicken. And I also put in many ingredients. Growing up in K-Town, back in the 90s, 80s and 90s, it was a mixed community. So there's a lot of Mexican influence in this chicken as well. We do a lot of fried chilies that we toss on top. The marinade is very Japanese. So that would obviously be from my father's side. We marinated in koji and shiitake mushroom powder and soy. So it gives it a lot of umami flavors. The crust is obviously from Pioneer Chicken. And the finishing, we finish it with like a Chinese chili oil and a Sichuan peppercorn powder. So it's very Los Angeles. I did a lot of time in New York City, and you would never, ever see that style fried chicken in New York City. It just wouldn't make sense. I love taking time and place. And Los Angeles, this is the fried chicken that says Los Angeles to me.
You know, I understand that golden rust color that's achieved once the wings have been dredged and fried is that signature chili oil with the Sichuan kick.
Yes. I mean, it adds so much depth of flavor, and it does, you know, once you fry it, it has that golden hue to it. And then we douse it in this chili oil, and it kind of adds another element to it, another flavor element. And then, of course, adds to the heat.
Do you serve them whole, or do you separate them into the drumette and the flat?
We serve them whole. I've always enjoyed eating the little crevices on the wingtip. So a lot of places cut the wingtip off. I love those little crevices, and I love the little crunchy bits. And when you cook it whole, you kind of utilizing that all that moisture from the bones and from the cartilage and connective tissues. So you get this really moist, juicy wing.
And what about the special Super Bowl sauces?
So we wanted to have fun with Super Bowl, obviously. This year, we have to try extra hard to have fun during Super Bowl. And I'm a big football fan, so we decided to make two sauces for the opposing team. So for the GOAT, the greatest of all time, Tom Brady, we did, now that he's down in Florida, we did a citrus mojo. And it's going to have, both sauces are going to have a kick to them, but the mojo is this sweet, sour kind of, kind of mojo sauce. And then for Kansas City, we had to do, of course, a Kansas City barbecue sauce.
It sounds really good. I was just going to make my own wings.
Well, we'll send over sauce, and then you can just have your own wings with some sauce.
It's so funny. If you are, an intuitive eater who just goes with the flow, this period of time, I have to say, is like really hard. It's like just super ADD.
I know we're all being bombarded with all of these different concepts, but it's fun. In the end, it's a good way to generate revenue for local businesses and have a good time doing it.
And I have to say, I hope it doesn't all go away. For you, will it all just disappear? Will these pivots disappear?
No, I've learned so much during this pandemic. Prior to this, I was just, I say just a chef, but there's so many different opportunities. And this pandemic has taught me a lot of how to build a small business and how to really connect with your diner. You know, it's not just about fine dining. It's not just about high-end food. It's about food that really touches people and kind of connects the two of you. So I've learned a lot. And no, but we're going to definitely keep these two businesses.
Do you have any sides with a twist that we can order to accompany our wings?
Yes. A lot of people enjoy our mashed potatoes and kurevi. So if you've ever had Japanese curry, we make our own in-house curry, and we top it on top of creamy mashed potatoes. We have coleslaw. We have French fries we cut in-house. And French fries have become a huge debate amongst staff, which kind of style fries they enjoy. These are a medium-sized cut, and we cover them in furikake.
Wow. That sounds great. And I have to say, when you were describing the mashed potatoes with the curry gravy, my mind just went to dipping the wing into the mashed potatoes, of course.
Totally. I used to love it. That's one thing I did really enjoy about Kentucky Fried Chicken is the fact that you can dip it in that creamy potato mixture that they make.
It's been so much fun talking to you, Brandon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was Chef Brandon Keita. Find Go-Go Bird on Talk, Postmates, and Uber Eats for his nostalgic but modern take on chicken wings. Coming up, if turning on the oven for a tray of chicken wings sounds like too much for you, I get it. We've got a lot of takeout recommendations when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I often wonder what we will remember from this utterly bizarre time that we're living in. When it comes to food, I will definitely remember both the pain and tenacity of my restaurant friends, but I'll also look back on this time as the golden age of the hustle. The pandemic version of eating out four nights a week is setting four different alarms on your phone to remind you to DM your pre-orders for that week's pop-ups. Chefs all over the country have been selling food from their home kitchens and even resorting to grilling kebabs in back alleys for those in the know. Keeping tabs on who's doing what, when, and where has become almost like a sport. Up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Chronicle critic Soleil Ho writes that the best and only way to enjoy these pop-ups is to embrace chaos. Here's Soleil.
When you go to as many pop-ups as I do, you quickly come to realize that enjoying them means throwing yourself through endless hoops, all in the name of finally getting to buy a thing. You swim into the riptide of minute-long ordering windows and contact chefs via Google Forms and direct messages. Then you hope you're waiting in the right line in some random place, dropping everything in order to pick something up when someone else tells you to. You embrace chaos. I can't count the number of times I've persuaded friends and family to come with me somewhere nondescript to pick something up, only for us to get lost and argue because none of us knows where exactly we're supposed to be going. Is it that parking lot? That apartment building? That cafe that looks like it's been under construction for 10 years? On rare occasions, I have to assure my compatriot that no, this isn't some setup where we're going to get murdered, but I don't really know that myself. Maybe we're walking into a trap, and my tombstone will read, and I quote, "I was told that there would be focaccia." Pop-ups are a broad category of ad hoc restaurant, including tasting menus hosted by rogue chefs, as well as tamale and taco vendors who set up folding tables outside of car dealerships. In the early 2000s, the term was mostly used to refer to the trend of high-end fashion houses like Comme des Garçons opening guerrilla stores in places like Berlin and Los Angeles in order to generate hype. But now, the popular understanding of the pop-up has flipped to one where up-and-coming cooks, without the means or opportunity to open restaurants, are able to scratch together a living on the gray market. One can see why this would be an especially resonant concept in the pricey Bay Area, even before the mass layoffs we've seen during the pandemic era. 2020 saw a steep increase in DM food, a term that I first heard uttered by LA Taco editor Javier Cabral. All over Instagram and Facebook, pop-up vendors hawk tiered cakes, garlic noodles, quesadilla tacos, barbecue plates, and more, available via direct message, that's DM, and texting by phone. When Charles Chen started Basuku, his Basque cheesecake business, he conducted all of his sales via Instagram direct messages. So did Moni Frailing, the co-founder of Bread Spread Pickle. Responding to all the missives quickly became a full-time job in itself. For me, getting the details straight on how to order what and when adds another layer of complication to the task of getting food. I often find myself practically begging to be allowed to just buy whatever pastry box is on offer, and then I wonder how I'm going to explain processes like this to my readers. Still, some readers have shown me the complicated calendar events and alarms they set each week to remind themselves of when they can try ordering the cheesecakes, pizzas, and desserts that have limited ordering windows. Picking up food takes on the air of a precious chance occurrence, like whale watching. I wouldn't blame anyone for just wanting to stick with brick-and-mortar restaurants for their reliability. For the most part, a restaurant will always keep its promises. You don't have to keep checking its Instagram to make sure you have this week's pickup address right. But some of the most exciting and novel experiments in food are happening at pop-ups, which hold a similar thrill as other forms of ephemeral creativity, like underground concerts, performance art, and maybe the most normie variant, flash mobs. People like me endure the busy phone lines, ridiculously long queues, and slap together ordering forms because we're looking for the specific excitement of experiencing something froth-like and fragile. Unconsciously, and perhaps foolishly, we who call June's pizza 20-plus times or more for a chance to buy a pie embrace Aeschylus's ancient observations on suffering, explored in his Oresteia, that there is advantage in the wisdom won from pain. Amidst a culture that privileges convenience and a customer-is-always-right mentality, maybe the stark inconvenience of pop-ups means something more, too. Pop-up culture has the potential to rewire dominant ways of thinking about diners' relationships to the people who make their food, away from the traditional and uneven servant-master dynamic, a more equitable reworking that workers in normal restaurants and cafes could benefit from as well. Not everything has to be easy or even comfortable. Sometimes that's the fun part.
Soleil, I have a couple of questions for you. What have some of your takeout, some of your favorite takeout meals from these pop-ups been?
There was one where I had to fill out a Google form and just kind of hope that they would get back to me. And that is Lowai. That's L-A-O-W-A-I. And it is this home project by a former sous chef where he is making these beautiful noodles where he went to China to learn how to make them. And it was just so there. You get the uncooked noodles and then you get the sauces to put together in the bowl. And that's it. And the simplicity was really, really, really nice.
And we should say that all this is happening up north down here in LA. So people don't think they can just run out and get these. So when you're filling out all of these Google Forms or all the hoops that we all have to fill out in order to get the foods, do you have any concerns about using an alias, or do you just, you know, let your Soleil flag fly, as it were?
Well, like the kids say, I have a Finsta account.
Oh,
so I'm able to use that to do a lot of my ordering.
So just for those not in the know, describe what that is.
You know, a lot of people have multiple Instagram accounts, not just people who have public personas. A Finsta account is just something that you have on the side where maybe you post the not cute pictures, for instance. Like it's more real, but it's a fake Insta. I don't know why. It seems backwards. But yes, I have multiple Instagram accounts. One of them is just for posting pictures of dogs I see on the street. So yeah, I'm okay.
Oh, I need to have access to that one.
No.
Do you think that, I mean, I am enchanted by the flowering of the creativity of cooks and chefs who often didn't really have to think about the entrepreneurial part of what they were doing. Do you think this is going to stick around post-pandemic?
I think so. I mean, as I point out in the story too, this is something that people have done for a long time, right? There are people who have sold food in the margins because they couldn't afford restaurant spaces, or they just weren't interested in the sort of quote unquote respectable way of doing food, or they, you know, they just want to serve their community and they're not really interested in further commercialization. I think more and more people just out of necessity have adapted that mindset. And it's a hard one to shake once you work for yourself, you know? I think a lot of people are probably not going to be that willing to throw into an industry that is so tumultuous, because we know there will be more pandemics and it's just a matter of how are you going to adapt.
Yeah, what I really hope is that somehow health departments continue to evolve in their own way to be more understanding of unique situations.
Yeah, I mean, we have sort of cottage food laws already on the books in California, and it's just a matter of individual counties adapting them and allowing people to get permits for their kitchens. So I think it's a matter of time, and I think we have the infrastructure already to enable this.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know we normally hear from our LA critics, but I was so taken by the tone of your essay that I really wanted to share it with everyone.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Soleil Ho is the restaurant critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. Takeout in 2021 has a new allure for me. Sure, it's convenient when I have a particularly busy day, but it's also a way to change up my daily routine and rejuvenate my palate because the truth is I am sick of my own cooking. So I thought it would be a good time to check in with Bill Addison, co-critic of the Los Angeles Times. He's here to entice us with the takeout update. Hi.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm okay. And I see that you are eating like a champ.
I was thinking about how we have these resolutions for January and February when we often eat less after the holidays, and that restaurants have their slowest times of the year usually during those months. And I just thought, I'm not making that resolution this year. I'm going to eat more, in fact, and I will revisit that resolution after restaurants are back open and this terrible pandemic is behind us. We need to be supporting our restaurants any way we can.
Yeah, it's true. To be honest, I haven't done a lot of takeout during the pandemic. It's never been a big part of my eating routine. But after a year of eating my own food, I'm really ready for a change. So entice us.
Okay, here are some things that I have been loving in early 2021. Straight out of the gate, ndole is a Cameroonian dish. The word ndole is for both the green, it's called bitter leaf often in English, and the dish. It's mixed with ground peanuts, and the seasonings give it this sort of smoky depth. You pick your choice of protein on top. A lot of people are loving it with shrimp. This is at Mama D's African Kitchen. It is a new restaurant in Boyle Heights. It's probably my favorite thing that I've eaten so far in 2021.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do you find out about places like this? Are you just exploring everybody's Instagram?
Yes, that's one way. Particularly, I think that we all used to do a richer combination of looking at each other's feeds and also driving around the city. And I think I'll just speak for myself. There's a lot less cruising around the city these days. I'm usually going to places with purpose. So I found this via the Eat the World LA blog. I noticed a bunch of the food writers in town noticed this place. And I ran right over, and I've been there twice in a week. I was that blown away.
It sounds great. Okay, what's the next one we should try?
Nasi Uduk Complete from Maidan Kitchen in Rosemead. What that refers to, the name of that dish, it's a tray of Indonesian dishes. There's beef rendang. There is sambal. There's fried chicken. There's tempeh with chilies. There's turmeric rice. There's spiced potatoes with anchovy and peanut. Again, looking to other colleagues, Kathy Chaplin at Eater LA, my former employers, she found that one. And it's run by 75-year-old Su Chen, who was just going out of her mind at home. She was a home cook, and she took over a vacated space in Rosemead and is cooking beautiful Indonesian food, which we don't see enough of in the LA area.
It really looks incredible.
Yes, I'm excited.
Okay, what else has been on your pickup list?
So nice to see LA sushi legend Morihiro Onodera. Everyone calls him Mori. I reviewed him when he was at his last gig at In An in Hollywood, and he's back. He opened a restaurant kind of out of the blue in Atwater Village. He had been thinking about doing a really like top of the line $300 per person omakase restaurant. And then 2020 happened, and he is now, like so many other sushi chefs, making beautiful bentos. So you'll find sashimi, grilled fish, pickles, a sushi bar meal in a box. I miss the intimacy of sushi bars maybe more than any other dining experience in LA, but this will remind you of what's to return.
How expensive is it?
He's changing it all the time, but it's in the $35 range for the basic one. So that's a good starting place. Sometimes he does more elaborate, like two bento versions, two box versions. But it's not crazy.
What a deal. He's so incredible. He just has trained so many of the sushi chefs that we know in here in town.
I hear temptation in your voice, Evan. I think I know where you're headed next.
I miss sushi so much.
Me too.
Okay, what's next?
I never got around to reviewing Miss Chi Cafe in Culver City from Shirley Chung. And so it's been nice to get to know her food some through takeout. She has a fixed price meal that has some mix and match options. So I had a meal recently that was pork and shrimp wontons and chili oil and salt and pepper shrimp with garlic aioli. And then my favorite was tea smoked duck with steamed lotus leaf buns. She's most famous for her cheeseburger dumplings with bacon jam. And they were great too, though I saved them for later and steamed them gently, and they came back to life and they were amazing for lunch the next day.
Wow, that sounds so good. Give us more.
So I guess like all of us, you know, it is such an indulgent thing to say something like, I miss travel, but I do miss travel. I was a paid wanderer for almost 5 years with Eater. And I've been thinking a lot about a trip to Hawaii that my colleagues and I took in 2017 that was very meaningful. It was wonderful to connect with local food writers and really understand the foodways of Hawaii in a deeper way that I had before. So I got my hankering fulfilled at Auntie Mele's Hawaiian Food in Torrance. She has a mixed plate of Kalbi short ribs and Kalua pig, which is the term for the roasted suckling pig that they pair with steamed cabbage. And they served it like a Hawaiian plate lunch with sides of rice and macaroni salad, which made me really happy.
Why wouldn't it? Sounds so good. Give us one more.
Last one, Peruvian food. Another cuisine I wish we saw more of in restaurants in the Los Angeles area. This is straight off of Tok, one of the great sites right now in Los Angeles that you can scroll, and people who don't necessarily have brick and mortar locations are offering their pop-up meals through that site. And this is tajarin a la huanqueña con lomo from Aymara Peruvian Kitchen. So talk about comfort. Get this. It is like lomo saltado almost combined with spaghetti. So it's beef sauteed with onions, tomato, and a red wine sauce. And then it's over spaghetti that's tossed in a spicy cream sauce and finished with Parmesan. It is like face plant food. I was in another realm by the time I finished it and grateful for it, because sometimes you need an escape from this reality.
Oh, big time. Well, you've given us lots of them. Thank you so much, Bill.
Always happy to be here, Evan. Thank you.
That was Bill Addison, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. We've got a list of all of his takeout recommendations on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, celebrating Chinese New Year with pomelos from the farmers market. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. LA always looks glorious after the rain, doesn't it? And this week at the farmers market, everything looked so much fresher than usual. Jillian Ferguson is at the Santa Monica Market, where she joins us with this report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. One of the best parts about my job is meeting new chefs and cooks, and I was so happy to connect with Sarifa Renton. who's the woman behind an interesting new pop-up called MinaRocks.LA. Sarifa started selling her Singaporean specialties out of the parking lot of Minati's coffee stop last summer in Culver City. And she's here at the market every week shopping for her menu. Hi, Sarifa.
Hello, good morning. So, Kong Hei Fat Choi, this is the way Cantonese speakers will greet each other during the Chinese New Year. So literally, the translation is wishing you great happiness and prosperity.
That's right. So this Friday is the celebration for the Chinese New Year, February 12th. What's on your menu? Are you celebrating?
Yes. On the menu, we have it's called Yisang. So it's a raw fish salad. And it's I think it's widely practiced in Singapore only, maybe. And it's a tradition where on the eve of Chinese New Year, the families and friends come together for what they call a reunion dinner. So to start off that festivities, they have a huge tray of salad, and it's really vibrant, colorful, and flavorful. And what's interesting is you stand around the table, and then you toss the salad.
All together?
Yes, everybody, it's a communal thing, right? So they come together, toss the salad. So the higher you toss the salad, and literally it becomes a mess. So the higher you toss, and you know, more good fortune will come your way. So literally it's like that.
How wonderful. So tell us all the ingredients that are in this salad.
So that's why we're here today, right? Picking up pomelos from Peter, Shana Farm Stand. So it's in season and it's amazing. It's a nice, fragrant, citrusy, just nice balance. Mm-hmm. So the pomelo will be included in it. I mean, the main ingredient is the raw fish. I will be using the salmon for that. And then we have the pomelo. And I just want to say, there's significant symbolism to all the ingredients that added into the salad. So, for example, the raw fish in Chinese, it symbolizes abundance throughout the year. And then the pomelos, in this case, will represent luck and auspiciousness. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this year is the year of the ox. So I kind of call my box the ox-piciousness.
That's cute.
So, and then the carrots will be like blessings of luck, and the green radish will be eternal youth, and then some of the spices that you add means like attract wealth and treasures.
Okay.
And the oil will be like money flowing in all directions. So basically, and then you have golden crackers, and may your path fill with gold, and then sesame seeds, and a dressing that's plum sauce, as well as, for my take, I'm going to add some kind of like to sweeten it with apricot, which I've saved from the summer. So I'll be adding it to the dressing.
Wow, this sounds incredible. So what's the experience of someone who is taking this home? Do they get all the different components and then they get to toss it with their family together?
Absolutely, they can do, you know, they can have fun, sitting around the table and then say the greetings and, you know, have a good time, basically. And of course, enjoy a yummy, you know, delicious meal.
Yes. What else is on the menu? Is that the main dish or are there a lot of different components on this week's menu?
So it will be kind of like a mini feast. So I will include the tray of salad that will be for two, that serves two. And then the other thing will be the longevity ifu noodles. So when you eat the noodles, don't cut it. So eat it and slurp. It's okay. You are at home. Nobody's watching you. So long noodles, so longevity. And so it will be with some scallops and mushrooms and then a little bit sweet dessert to sweeten the deal.
This all sounds fantastic. Sarifa, it's so wonderful to meet you. You are an absolute delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jillian, for choosing me to be your guest today. I'm so excited and happy to meet you. And we're going to enjoy a beautiful day today.
We sure are. That was Sarifa Renton of MinaRocks.LA. You can pre-order her Chinese New Year menu via Instagram. Make sure to put in your order by Wednesday of this week. Check it out at Mina, M-I-N-A-H, Rocks, R-O-C-K-S, dot L-A on Instagram. Peter Shaner of Shaner Family Farms is the farmer who Sarifa is buying her pomelos from. And Peter, you are well known for the citrus that you bring up each week from Valley Center. What I'm hoping that you can do for us right now is give us a bit of a pomelo 101, starting with what is the difference between a pomelo and a grapefruit?
The pomelo is the mother, the original fruit, the mother of the fruit, came from China. And it's very, very thick skin, and the flesh is dry, but sweet, as opposed to your typical grapefruit, which is juicy and tart. Because of its sweetness, the University of Riverside used it to breed with other grapefruit, and they came up with the Oro Blanco and the cocktail grapefruit, also known as a mandolo, where you have a sweeter grapefruit and a juicier fruit. So it wasn't as dry as a pomelo, but it wasn't as tart as a regular grapefruit. So it combined and made a very, very appetizing fruit.
Wow. So one of the signature characteristics of a pomelo is that thick skin that you mentioned. What is it doing for the fruit?
It does protect the fruit from exterior damage. And it also, once the fruit is picked, you can store it. The fruit has a longer shelf life just outside. The skin will shrivel up a bit, but the membrane inside, the flesh inside would still be good.
And these pomelos are enormous. I mean, they can get up to 2, 3, 4 pounds. What did they look like on the tree? I mean, I can't imagine a tree that can hold up a bunch of these fruits.
Well, fortunately, the citrus trees do bend to a great degree, as opposed to an avocado tree that do not bend and the branches break. The citrus trees and pomelo trees, they do bend. So they can carry the fruit well on the tree.
Are the pomelo trees as prolific as lemon and orange trees?
No, the thing with they don't produce as much as lemons or oranges or grapefruit. The reason they call grapefruit is the grapefruit would grow in clusters like grapes. Not clusters, but they'll be bunched up like grapes. So grapefruits would produce more. Pomelos are more singular. They don't produce a lot of fruit, but the fruit that they produce can get big. And like you said, you know, pound-wise, 2 or 3 pounds, but as big as volleyballs or basketballs even.
It is extraordinary. So what's the season for this fruit?
Right now is the season for this fruit. We're about halfway through it. It started about a month ago. It's a short season because they don't stay on the tree very long, but they do stay on your counter a long time because of their thick skin.
Well, they're so delicious. Peter, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
That was Peter Shaner of Shaner Family Farms. You can find him every Wednesday at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
This past year has given us countless bizarro headlines, but I wasn't prepared for this one. The FDA has approved its first genetically modified pig for consumption. Wow. The term GMO in the food world has a cringe factor, but mostly it presents a lot of questions. Why do we need a GMO pig? Who is benefiting from it? And what, if any, are the risks involved? Jessica Fu is a staff writer for The Counter, and she joins me with some answers. Hi, Jessica.
Hey.
What is a genetically modified animal?
So that's kind of a broad category that refers to any kind of engineering that's done to an animal's genetic makeup to change its characteristics for various reasons, whether it's to remove a protein that might cause allergic reactions or to make it grow better under certain conditions, like warmer temperatures, for example.
Is this the first animal that's ever been genetically modified for human consumption?
No. In the past, the FDA has approved a genetically engineered salmon, a genetically modified salmon, if you will, for human consumption. So that's already been greenlit.
And that one was to make it grow faster, I believe, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But this one is quite different. How does the approval of this particular animal benefit certain people?
So one of the things that excited a few people when this approval was announced was the fact that it might be okay for people who suffer from a red meat allergy to consume. I don't know if you're familiar, but more and more people are suffering from this very particular allergy to red meat products due to a specific sugar that red meat produces called alpha-gal. So people who suffer from alpha-gal syndrome get allergic reactions essentially when they eat either animal products or they use products maybe on their skin, such as cosmetics, that contain animal products, which is actually quite common. In this case, this pig was modified so that it doesn't produce alpha-gal, that sugar that triggers the allergic reactions. So there's hope that this might be able to produce pork that red meat allergy sufferers can consume.
Was this the sole reason that this particular animal was created, or was that a side benefit they discovered?
My understanding from speaking with the company behind the GalSafe pig is that this was kind of a bonus. The company behind the GalSafe pig actually focuses on developing biotechnology for use in human transplants, so for medical purposes, organs for the use in surgery for humans. And this was framed as an unexpected benefit, so to speak, of an approval.
This alpha-gal syndrome, I understand that it's becoming increasingly common. Does anyone understand why?
There's a few theories as to why that's happening. One researcher who focuses on alpha-gal syndrome said that it's potentially being driven by a boom in the population of deers that carry ticks. Oftentimes, alpha-gal syndrome sufferers will have previously been bitten by ticks, and there's a theory that those ticks trigger a reaction in the body, and if they carry alpha-gal and inject that into the victim of a bite, any other exposure to alpha-gal in the future will also trigger that kind of a reaction.
Wow. It just shows you how our ecosystem is so intertwined.
Absolutely.
So who was behind seeking the FDA's approval?
So I hope I pronounced this company's name right. It's a company called Revivicor. Their GalSafe pig was approved in December. But I understand that there are a number of other biotech companies that are also interested in getting FDA approval for genetically engineered pigs, and that the pork industry is well aware that there are more and more genetically modified pigs that might be in the pipeline.
Hmm. Where are these particular GalSafe pigs going to be raised?
These ones are going to be raised in a farm in Iowa, and FDA's approval is limited to this particular facility, and I believe it's only 1,000 pigs per year that will be raised at this particular facility. So other genetically modified organisms or farms that will produce them will need to go through the FDA approval process separately.
What are critics of the FDA's, what they see to be rush to approval, saying?
I've heard a few comments. The Center for Food Safety has some concerns about whether or not FDA adequately looked at the potential for GalSafe pigs to cause food allergies. FDA's approval noted that GalSafe pigs are free of alpha-gal, but they didn't actually do allergy testing. So there are some critics who think that there needs to be an extra layer of scrutiny to really make sure that people who suffer from alpha-gal syndrome won't for any reason get any reaction triggered from them after eating pork from GalSafe pigs. There's also an environmental concern, the concern that if these genetically engineered pigs escape from the farm for some reason that they might pose a risk to wildlife and wild hogs. It definitely parallels the genetically modified salmon approval that I mentioned earlier. In that case as well, a lot of environmental activists were concerned about, you know, genetically modified salmon escaping and wreaking havoc in the ocean. So there's a concern that recurs every time we get one of these approvals. There's a lot we don't know about what we don't know. And so that's definitely on everyone's minds.
Since the salmon have existed for a while, have there been any escapees?
So my understanding is that the salmon was only approved in 2015 and that it's primarily bred indoors. I don't believe that there have been any escapes of this specific salmon, though there have been escapes of salmon farmed in the open ocean, just not genetically engineered salmon.
Could we start seeing GMO pork on menus or in supermarkets anytime soon? Or is this something that's looming in the farther future?
My understanding is that there's a lot of time between where we are right now and when we might be able to see genetically modified pork on the shelves at Whole Foods. My understanding is that there is not a lot of capacity right now to bring this to market at a mass scale. Like I said, the approval only pertains to one hog farm in Iowa that produces 1,000 pigs a year, which is not really enough to distribute pork nationwide. But it is kind of an indicator of potentially where the winds are blowing.
As a cynic, I have to ask myself if this was a bid to find a market for the rest of the animal that they don't use after they use all the parts for human transplantation.
I definitely have that same question. Even just the framing that this is an extra market opportunity, it suggests to me that this is another way to kind of extract value maybe from a pig that is primarily meant for a different purpose other than food.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Jessica Fu. To read her article for The Counter on the FDA's approval of genetically modified pigs, visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. This week's In the Weeds is coming up next. Stay close. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Timing is everything. Just as Tazita Alamayu was about to fulfill her dream of a brick-and-mortar restaurant to serve her Ethiopian-influenced vegan food, COVID struck. Undeterred, she opened TNT Lifestyle at the Colony Kitchen Food Hall in West LA last spring. Powered by green power pancakes and a superfood combo, Tazita is here for this week's segment of In the Weeds.
My name is Tazita Alamayo. My restaurant name is TNT Lifestyle. It's a fully vegan restaurant. We are inside the Colony. TNT Lifestyle provides a vegan Ethiopian twist food. My background is Ethiopian, so I use all the Ethiopian spices to make it Ethiopian twist. 2016, I started at Farmers Market on 5th and Spring while I was in culinary arts school. And then while I was doing that, I got the cottage food operation to also cook from home. Once I did Farmers Market for 3 months and school got a little bit hectic, so I stopped doing the Farmers Market and focused on school while I'm doing the cottage food operation from home just for my neighbors and some clients. And then 2019, we started Smokesburg. And while we were at Smokesburg, we were looking for a restaurant around the west side. A friend of ours suggested that we look at this place, Gold Colony. It's just exactly how I want my kitchen to look like and everything. So we were supposed to open in March. We had everything ready, and then the pandemic happened. So we had to push it a little bit, waited until May, and we opened TNT Lifestyle inside the colony in May 7th. And it's going great. It's so important for us to share my food with everybody because one, it's introduced the culture behind my Ethiopian culture behind it, and also the importance of eating vegetables and fruits. I have been a vegan for the past 6 years now. It's been an amazing journey. I was a vegetarian before that for a long time. And I just wanted to share my lifestyle with everybody. That's why I came up with the name TNT Lifestyle. It's my husband and my initial. So we're just sharing our lifestyle. I grew up in Ethiopia around Bole area, by the airport area. And the memories I have eating food back home is all of us sit together. There is a big tray, and we put the injera in the middle and all type of sauces. And then we all eat from that plate, that one big plate, because we like to share our food. And that's a part of the culture. And I miss that. I will always remember that. Injera is at the center of Ethiopian food, and my customer calls it this spongy bread, and they love it so much. Like how you eat Indian food, they eat with their hands as well. So they break the bread and then they dip into the sauces. So the same way with Ethiopian food, injera, you break the injera, and then there's the whatever it is you have on your plate. So let's say the red lentils, you just dip it in, and then you feed yourself and you eat with hands, with your fingers. The injera is made out of teff. Teff is one of the smallest grain in the world, and it's originated from Ethiopia. And everybody does it differently, makes it differently. The original one is the way they make it back home is it's a 3 or 4 days process, the fermentation process. But I was able to cut that down somehow with the help of my auntie. So it's basically just water, then teff, and active yeast or dry yeast, and you let it ferment overnight, basically 15, 16 hours, and then it'll be ready the next day. Our main spice in Ethiopia, the main major one, is berbere, which is the red chili, the spicy one. We use that a lot, and I have it in my red lentils. I have it in the Ethiopian twist tacos. It's very, very important for Ethiopian culture. If you don't put berbere in it, it's not Ethiopian food enough. So we have it here. I use it a lot here. I want people to know Ethiopian food could be a comfort food, a very healthy variety. It has a little bit of everything. I want people to know about the taste, the aroma, the smell. And just the injera, the bread that we use, that is 100% gluten-free. Being a restaurant owner at this moment, just because of the situation, the pandemic we are in, it's a little bit stressful. We just don't know what to expect. Our numbers change based on, you know, the lockdown. The last one affected us, and so, of course, it's a little bit stressful, but at the same time, it's rewarding. If it feels amazing at the same time. Giving up is not the option. I never wanted to give up. If anything, I wanted to push more. I'm putting that energy towards, you know, creating other new recipes, new dishes. So overall, it's a blessing. Our customers, clients that we built when we were at Farmers Market or Smogsburg, they came to support us continuously, nonstop. They've been sending friends, they've been coming. It's overwhelming a little bit, it's beautiful. Now we are allowed to have the outdoor dining. It's super great for us because that's how it was in the beginning when we first opened. We had the outdoors, so we're going back to normal. And the LA people love to enjoy the sunlight eating outside, so it's great for us. It's great for the business.
That was Tizita Alamayu. Her restaurant, TNT Lifestyle, is open for business at the Colony Kitchen Food Hall in West LA. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. I'd love to know where you're getting takeout these days. Send me a DM or email us. We're at goodfood@kcrw.com. And I'm going to start sharing some takeout tips from our friends of the show, like this one from writer Bill Esparza.
I'm Bill Esparza. My favorite to-go place is Northern Thai Food Club here in Hollywood, and I'll have whatever they have in the steam tables.
That's it for this week. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.